You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Gwendolyn Keist is the author of And Her Smile Will Untether the Universe, Pretty Marys All in a Row, The Rust Maidens, The Invention of Ghosts, Bone Set and Feathers, and Reluctant Immortals. Her new novel is The Haunting of Velkwood. Thank you for joining me, Gwendolyn.
Thank you so much for having me back.
You know, one of the things that about ghosts that I find most interesting is the way that you set them up in this book. Is it's really a time-oriented experience.
Mm, yeah.
So talk about your use of time in this novel. Was it something that you just wrote as you created the novel, or did you have like a sketch of how this was going to work out in the novel before you started writing it?
You know, I had a general idea. I like how you say that it really is very time dependent, because basically when you kind of go into this ghostly neighborhood, you basically go back in time. The whole neighborhood is stuck in the past and is a ghost. So it was something that I had an idea of when I started writing it, but it definitely evolved as I went along. And, you know, I got the idea of the layout of the neighborhood. And, you know, I had an idea of what it looked like when I started, but as I kept moving through it, you know, I made more sketches and I knew, you know, where everything was and the physical location of it, since it is kind of an ephemeral place in a lot of ways.
You know, also one of the things I like most about this book is I was born in a suburb many years ago, in the last century, and I've lived all my life in the suburbs, and I've never seen them really written out in a way that, you know, mapped to my experience. I was the kind of kid who would, like, instead of going to high school football games, I'd ride my bicycle around the empty suburbs at night and kind of like I would haunt the suburbs, as it were. And I think that this book captures that kind of experience of the suburbs as a place that haunts itself, essentially.
Yes, I like that, as a place that haunts itself. I like that a lot. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So I grew up much more in just like a small town, but every time I think of like an area that looked like the suburbs as I saw it in, you know, movies and TV, is actually where my cousins grew up. And they grew up a little like further north of where we lived. And so I always think of their street every time I think of the suburbs. And so when I was writing this, I was really kind of writing of like what I remembered, you know, playing with them. They were a little bit older than me. And so it's like, you know, when you're young and you're always trying to catch up with the older kids, right? And so like that was the experience I was sort of bringing to it. And I'm glad that resonated with you as somebody who has lived in the suburbs your whole life.
It also, I really like the characters in this. So just kind of give us an idea of the setup, because the main character, Talitha Velkwood, is really fascinating. She's not a super accomplished person in any sense.
She is not. That's like a big crux of her character, is that, you know, so what happened was the setup of the book is that she and her two friends were left for college, and the next day their entire neighborhood turned into a ghost. They went back after spring break and everybody else was a ghost. And so in the time since then, it's been like 20 years, you know, she hasn't really accomplished very much at all. Like you said, she's just kind of floating through life. She's very trapped in the past herself, because, you know, she's got a lot of guilt over that, kind of being the survivor of this thing that, you know, took her mother, took her sister, took all, you know, her friends' families. And so, yeah, she's really kind of a bit of a ghost herself. And then her two friends, Brett and Grace. Grace is even doing worse than Talitha, as we learn as it goes along. And Brett has sort of gone the opposite way and has been very successful. So I wanted to really look at how tragedy affects people. Sometimes some people, you know, dig in their heels and are like, okay, like I'm going to keep moving forward, and other people get stuck. And I really wanted to explore, you know, what those reactions are like through these characters.
You used a really important word just now, tragedy. And I think that, in a sense, this book is really delves into the heart of tragedy and uses the supernatural idea of a ghost to externalize all the facets of tragedy, of trauma, of PTSD, and to give them more essence, more activate them as a supernatural, using the supernatural tropes. And I think that's a really effective way to explore these characters, because at its heart, this book is a beautiful exploration of a, it's a love story. And I think that it's a really wonderful way, dark and wonderful and very weird way to explore that idea.
Yeah, and that is something I've always loved about ghost stories that sort of can work on more than one level, that you've got the ghost, and so you've got that cool horror element, because I just love ghosts, however they're depicted. Usually I'm a big ghost story person and always have been, both in literature and in film. But I really do like it when the kind of ghost means something different to the people that are being haunted in whatever way. So that's something that I definitely wanted to bring to the story.
And also, I think in any novel, no matter what how interesting the characters and everything else is, you read a novel on a sentence level. You read it sentence by sentence, and there are so many wonderful, great, pithy sentences that echo in this novel that refer both to themselves, to parts of the novel, but also to, you know, the ghosts that haunt us, which, I mean, alas, I would like to be haunted by the spirits of the dead. Instead, I'm haunted by the spirits of the many mistakes I have made in my life.
I feel like we all are, right? In one sense or another. And that was also something I was thinking about when writing this, you know, that I feel like Talitha feels like she's made a lot of mistakes. And so that's something that haunts her. I do think we can have ghosts that are not necessarily supernatural, that are just the ghosts of our own lives. I think that that's probably the most common ghost out there, right? I feel like we all have one or two of those.
Yeah, or an entire army, depending on your life experience. Talk about creating the locale, Velkwood itself. It's the she is the Talitha lives in the first house established in a new neighborhood, and that actually I wasn't in the first house, but my parents, when I was in college, moved into an early house into a suburb that ended up being built out all around them at the edge of Orange County. So, and it was actually the place where Dean Koontz set one of his novels, I think, Strangers. It was a quite, you know, it was a weird kind of place to be out there on the edge.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. I always love that. Like, the book is called The Haunting of Velkwood, and it's Velkwood Street, but it's also Talitha's last name, because I always found it interesting that a lot of times the first person who moves to a street can name it. I didn't know that till I was a little bit older, and I'm like, oh, that's so cool. And so I do like, you know, these places are like such organisms, and they have this like whole ecosystem of the suburbs. And so, yeah, like when I One of the initial ideas for this was this photography book that I found called Suburbia by photographer Bill Owens. And I found it, I found it because that was the book that Sofia Coppola used as inspiration for The Virgin Suicides. And I've always loved that movie so much. I love the book too, but I actually think I love the movie more. I love how visual she made it. And so I sought out this book because of that. And then since then, I found out it was also used as inspiration for Close Encounters of the Third Kind and for Edward Scissorhands. And so it's like had this very interesting life as kind of inspiration, almost like the mood board for a lot of different things. And as I was looking at it, the pictures, they seem very banal and commonplace, but they've got these great captions, and he did a great job of really capturing this kind of malaise and this almost haunting feeling of suburbia. And so that was like one of the things I was first thinking of. And from there, I'm like, okay, if I want to do something like this, you know, what's unique about mine? You know, what does my street look like? What does the street in this story look like? And kind of, like I said, building it out from there. I had it all mapped out where everybody's house was and everything, and like the kind of shape of the street. And yeah, and so just really trying to, you know, be like, they're all split levels, because I've always loved split level houses. The house that I was talking about, my cousins, where they grew up, it was a split level. And I just always thought it was so cool. Like, you know, I lived in a duplex when they moved in there, and I just was like, oh, this split level, this is like, this is the life. And so like split levels are always in my fiction because I loved them so much. They're so dated now, but I still love them.
Oh, one of my good friends has a split level house. So
yay!
they're not that dated. You know, I'd like to, let me just read a little bit, one of the sentences I grabbed. This is the one thing we all agreed on. Whenever we were asked, Grace, Brett, and I always said it was just the three of us, nobody else, no other friends. And I think this is also not an uncommon experience of, you know, friends grow up in the same school and grow up in suburbia. Talk about that kind of the isolation that you get by having close friends who share your alienation from the place that you are like thrust upon.
It's such an interesting idea. And especially as I was writing this and I've been thinking about it and talking about it more now, I thought a lot about that and about the people that I was friends with when I was younger and how we all probably needed a lot more friends, because like you said, you get so isolated. You end up only having these people, you know, these friends around you, and you all kind of have the same experience, which on the one level is good, but on the other level, you have no perspective. And I realized that the way I kind of looked at things as a teenager, I don't necessarily look at them that way now, because I've gotten out in the world and I've met other people and I've had other experiences. But you know, when I was younger, like we were all going through a lot of the similar things. You tend to be friends with people of the same kind of socioeconomic background and things like that. So it's like we all kind of had the same types of problems with our parents, with each other, and we weren't able to get any perspective. I hope they also went out into the world. I don't talk to all of them that much, but like I hope they went out into the world and got more experiences that I couldn't offer them, because like I don't always think we were good for each other. Because like you said, there is a sense of isolation a lot of times with friends, especially in like small areas or small towns.
One of the things I thought was a really interesting writerly decision you made is that the characters come back to this small town that used to be the object of all the tabloids and, you know, This is real ghost documentaries that, you know, cover the world and the internet today. And they're accompanied by these researchers. One of them, his name is Jack, and he's kind of a lot nice, handsome guy, a little bit bland. But the rest of them are not even named and only rarely described. Yeah. And that, even though they come back in many scenes through the novel, mm-hmm. I think the only description that with them of them that stuck with me was that they were like white blood cells, like pus, accumulating around the danger.
Oh, yeah, I do think I described that, yeah.
So talk about the interesting decision, because on one hand, you know, we start to wonder, are we ever going to hear about their names or who they are? And then after a while, you think, you know, that's really a smart decision. You cut out a ton of words about characters we don't kind of care about, but yet we want to know who they are. Wow, that was a really good decision on your part.
Oh, good. I'm glad that worked for you. Like, I'm sure that's like a mileage may vary, right? Because I'm sure some people are like, give us more. I want the researcher's story. But my opinion was it wasn't their story. And like, you had to have people there. And I also wanted to kind of express that Talitha has trouble with people a lot. She's not very good with dealing with people. She's very isolated. And so my thought was, because I think at one point she even says they introduce themselves, but she just can't hold on to any of their names. And I feel like a lot of us has had that experience. You meet like five people at once and you can't remember any of them. If you met one or two people, you might be able to remember them. But if you meet like five or six people at once, like you can't remember anyone. So I thought it was like kind of how disoriented she was and, you know, how isolated she was, but then also not spending a lot of time of being like, this researcher's background is that they went to this college and this researcher's background is that they went here, and, you know, really trying to keep it focused on what's really happening in this neighborhood.
Now, this neighborhood is kind of, it's off limits to everybody, mostly because most people can't get in. Only three people can get in are three protagonists, Grace, Brett, and Talitha. Early on in the book, Talitha meets, she's met this researcher, Jack, and agrees to go back in, in part for, you know, she's compelled by a reason which I won't reveal. But I thought her journey, when she goes into this place, it's a classic otherworld journey. This is along, you know, the experiences of, and there are lots of kind of versions of this that, you know, have the same effect, you know, experiences with elves, sprites, and fairies, experiences with extraterrestrials, drug experiences, where you go into a place that's like reality but not like reality, and you meet people who may or may not be, or creatures who may or may not be what you see. I mean, Alice in Wonderland is another excellent example. Mm-hmm. Talk about creating otherworld journeys. Did you research other worlds?
Not specifically for this project, but, you know, some of the ones you named, I'm obviously a big fan of. Alice in Wonderland's the one I'm a big fan of. So, like, just kind of pulling from all of those different fields. And I like that you brought up folklore and, like, you know, elves and you know, the fae and things like that. And, you know, there's a few mentions of witchcraft in the book. It's not anything huge, but I kind of like to, you know, bring that in to some extent as well. Like, you know, but yeah, like it was fun kind of creating that other world, of having that place that they kind of go into, and it's like, okay, now this is a very different place than what we're going to be returning to, or at least hopefully returning to, because, you know, they don't want to get stuck there. But, you know, that becomes a fear at several points.
You know, I had my own kind of ghostly experience in reading this book, which was that at one point you talk about Rip Van Winkle, which is, again, another classic otherworld story. And I thought, oh my, she's talking about otherworlds. I wonder if she researched this. And I thought, I remembered a book that I read probably 15 or so years ago that I really liked, that was about the otherworld journey. But I couldn't remember either the author or the title of the book. So it took me a while, and I'm like thinking other worlds, and then I remembered it was called The Field Guide to the Other World. Oh. And so I put that in the search engine, and it brought up, you know, an Amazon listing with, you know, the author. The book is called Daemonic Reality, A Field Guide to the Other World. The author is Patrick Harper. It's a lovely book. It's just kind of this almost random compilation of, like, ghost sightings, ET sightings, witches, the whole thing. And the way it's written, it's very beautiful, kind of low-key prose. I really enjoyed reading it. So I looked it up on Amazon, and it kind of came up. And so I thought, well, I'll just see what the reviewer says. And I'm reading this review. I think, boy, this prose is really familiar to me. I must know this reviewer. And then I realized, I am this reviewer.
I love it.
And to be honest, I would never submit my reviews to Amazon because they're not paying me, so they're not going to get my money. They're my hard work. But I looked, and the entire review was there, and it even was attributed to me. And I'm guessing because it was a good review, the publisher stuck it in.
Ah, okay.
But it was such a weird experience of, this person? Who is this person? What is this? Oh, yeah, I see. So it was a perfect example of how we haunt ourselves, which is definitely a theme of this book, because most importantly, you know, the driving force at the center of this book is this romantic relationship. 40 years ago or 30 years ago when this book, the inciting incident takes place. Our mores were very different than they are now.
Yeah.
So talk about using, the sexual tension throughout the novel.
Yes. So yes, it is. It's got a queer romance in it. And so, yeah, dealing with those issues. So, you know, the two characters, they're 40 in the modern part of the book, and they met when they were kids. And, you know, everything they kind of, like, once the neighborhood disappeared, then that's really when they weren't as close anymore, though they still, you know, were friends, but it was kind of like a difficult friendship. But yeah, trying to deal with the fact that 20 years ago, you know, or 30 years ago when they would have met, like, it was different. It was, you know, not that there aren't a lot of challenges, you know, for us in the LGBTQ community now. There obviously are plenty, unfortunately, but you know, there are things that have gotten better. There is a lot more acceptance of same-sex relationships. And so that is something that kind of comes into the novel as to how the world has changed since these characters were children and how that affects them.
You know, too, I want you to, there, you have some just wonderful set pieces in this book. I mean, whenever they go into the zone, as it were,
mm-hmm.
It's really a kind of electrifying, and to a certain extent, it's better than a movie made of the same thing, but it's also reminiscent of movies. And so, talk about, you know, were there movie influences on your literary creation?
Trying to think, like, I brought up the Virgin Suicides. I often think of that one and just that neighborhood and how it was a very beautiful movie, but it's such a sad movie. And I think that was an interesting juxtaposition of, here's this very beautiful, dreamlike cinematography, and it's just all photographed so beautifully, but it's such a sad, sad film, and it's such a sad topic. And so I was thinking about that. And I did, like I said, I loved the fact that the same book inspired the Virgin Suicides neighborhood and the Edward Scissorhands neighborhood, because you can see it once you kind of know that. They're both sort of surreal in a way, but they don't seem like they're the same. But then I loved the fact that they were both kind of inspired from one of the same places. So I was thinking of, like, neighborhoods like that. I'm trying to think of, you know, other things. I remember having a lot of mood boards that had kind of these suburban neighborhoods from, like, the 70s and that era, even though the story really takes place, they build their allotment at the end of the 80s, but I like the idea of it having kind of more of a little bit of a dated look even then, so it would have had more of, like, a 70s look to it. And so I was thinking that. And yeah, those are the ones that really jumped to mind, but I'm sure that there were others.
You know, also too, the parents in this novel play a big part. Not always a happy one.
No.
So talk, I really like that this book kind of focuses on pretty much every character in this book is traumatized, delusional, dysfunctional,
yes.
Self-induced unhappiness, happiness-induced, yes. Unhappiness-induced by the people around them. Talk about the mother-daughter relationship between Talitha and her mother.
Yeah. So, I mean, like you said, it's very dysfunctional. Like, her mom, so Talitha's dad, I mean, this I don't think is a spoiler. We find this out fairly early on that her dad passes away when she's fairly young. She can remember him, but her little sister, who's like 8 when the neighborhood disappears, really can't. Sophie, the little sister, was maybe like 4, I think, when the dad died. So, like, you know, Talitha is left with her mother and having to take care of her little sister, and the mother kind of just falls apart. Like, you get the impression she was probably not a great mother even when the dad was alive, but then when the dad goes, she just falls apart and is acts out in a lot of pretty mean-spirited and hateful ways toward the kids. And meanwhile, Talitha's trying to be the one to kind of raise her sister and you know, make sure she's there for the little sister, who ends up being like a big part of the reason that Talitha goes back, is, you know, to try to find her sister and to be there for her sister. But yeah, you know, one of the things that I always find so interesting about suburbia is oftentimes you have these stories of people who live in small town neighborhoods, or any neighborhood, really. It could be anywhere. It could be the suburbs. It could be an urban neighborhood. It could be small town. Kids are a lot of times left to their own devices. This may not be as true now, but I know even when I was growing up 25, 30 years ago, and my husband's a little bit older, and like, he definitely had that experience. Like, kids are just left alone. Like, you have to figure out your own way a lot of times, and the parents just kind of aren't there. And so I thought that that would be interesting to bring into it, because a lot of these parents, they're not there for these kids, and their kids are just kind of on their own and having these really weird and at times supernatural experiences that nobody is like, you know, even if they try to talk about, the parents are like, just stop, that didn't happen. And so, like, I wanted to kind of deal with that, and also just that alienation you feel very often from family, especially when you're young.
I like the way you introduce the supernatural element in this. Everything about this novel is low key. It doesn't, like, you know, it's not like, even though it's inspired by the same book that inspired Close Encounters, it's not like there's no giant shining lights in the sky. And even the pretty spectacular set pieces that have to do with Velkwood and when it starts to change are still, you know, it seems, as it were, somewhat believable. And so I'd like you to talk about, did the supernatural core that we find out pretty far into the book that drives the book, did that come out early in your writing process, or was that just a result of you sitting there and creating and talk about developing it? Was the substructure of the entire novel retrofitted into what you'd already written?
I feel like, you know, I had a good idea of the kind of basic bones of the book when I started. There were definitely things that evolved as I went along, but I think I understood, like you said, kind of what was, you know, driving the haunting very early on. Again, you know, I don't feel like this is too much of a spoiler, because I think you get the idea. The dysfunctional relationships really are very much at the center, because that's sort of what ultimately kind of is the engine to keep this haunting going. And so I think I knew right away that that was the direction I was going to take it. And so, yeah. So I feel like that wasn't, I mean, there's always some things I feel like as authors you have to retrofit. I love that. I'm going to start thinking of it like that. I always call it back building, that I'll get to the end and I'm like, oh, I got to go back and build in some things, like, you know, to make sure that this is teased before the very end. But I most like that basic structure of knowing where I was going to end it, I, you know, and kind of that evolution of the neighborhood. I think I did know that pretty early on. There were some things throughout that kind of surprised me, you know, maybe specific character actions, or being like, okay, this character is going to be a little more like this, or this character is going to be a little more like that. But most of that kind of basic stuff, I think I had the idea of pretty early on.
The scariest aspects of this book are not necessarily the supernatural hauntings, but the all too unnatural human desires that run through some of the characters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, humans are really great at creating PTSD in one another.
Yes, not, they are.
Not necessarily an evolutionary asset, as far as I can tell, but so. Talk about, you know, the kinds of human, you know, it must be, is it unpleasant to create really unpleasant people?
You know, yes, I would say yes. Maybe not all authors feel that way, but especially some of the characters in this book more for me. Because, I mean, sometimes you can create like a dislikable villain, but they're fun. And that's maybe not so bad. But, Yeah, some of the really mean-spirited characters, the really terrible characters in this book, definitely left their mark on me and was like, I'm was glad to kind of be done with this book. I love this book. I'm very proud of this book, but I was very glad to be finished with it when I was done with it, because there are, and I you're that's such a great line of humans are so good at creating PTSD in one another. It's so sadly true. And this really is a book about that, about people who are very harmful to one another, especially the parents or the step parents to these teenagers. And the teenagers are really left on their own. And I would agree. Like I feel like there's some creepy moments. Definitely, this is definitely a horror book. But to me, the things that scared me the most to write were the real world stuff, the stuff of like people knowing that bad things are happening to some of these characters when they're kids, and everybody just being like, none of my business. That to me is more frightening than ghosts, because ghosts, like I always say, if you can get out of the haunted house or the haunted neighborhood in this case, you're probably safe from the ghosts, but people are everywhere. So it's like that's what scares me more.
And of course, if the people aren't scaring us, you write so many great sentences and little bits in here, like, I didn't escape it. That's because I never escape anything. I'm a fly in the ointment of my own life. I mean, that could go on a lot of tombstones.
That's funny.
You know, but I think too, it speaks to the real power of this novel is it's packed with sentences and paragraphs like that. And so the power of this novel is the awful insight into the nature of existence. I mean, you know, who let me here we go. Who cares about the Walking Dead? But they bring to mind the inevitability of life. But for most of us, the spirits of our past mistakes are an even more terrifying reminder of the futility of life. Is it, so talk about, creating a novel where the big bad are these stupid things we do, and they're often some small things that only in retrospect we go, wow. I just said that like off the top of my head. It was the worst thing I ever said in my entire life. And my entire life is ruined because of this stupid thing I thought was so smart to say.
There is something, yeah, about the ways that we do treat each other and the things that we do and the marks that we leave on each other. And that was very much something that like I was thinking about throughout, because Talitha, is our main character, but she makes a lot of mistakes throughout the book. I mean, she made mistakes before we meet her. She makes mistakes throughout the book. She's very indecisive. There were times that I was just like, oh, like that's her character, and that's a big part of her arc is to stop being indecisive. But it was something that I was like, as I was writing it, I'm like, this is, frustrating, because it's like, she's so afraid to make a choice, but by not making a choice, she still made a choice, right? Like a lot of times, it can be this thing of like, I'm not going to do anything because that seems safer, but that's a choice too. And, it creates a lot of problems for her and for the other characters that, she's taking so long to figure things out that leaves its marks too. So that is definitely with these characters. They each make a lot of choices that later on that it's like, from the outside, and that's another thing. I feel like when you're looking at somebody else's life, it's always easier to be like, here's what they clearly need to do. And you may be right, you may not be right, but it's like you usually don't have the insight into your own life. Like you could have the same situation that you'll see in somebody else. You're like, they should do A, B, and C, and everything will be fine. But then in your own life, you're like, oh, I don't know what to do. Or maybe I'll do this other thing, or I'm gonna avoid it. And it's like you would have such a different reaction if you were watching it from somebody like another perspective. But yeah, so.
Well, right there, you've summarized much of the power of this novel. But I don't want to undersell the horror aspects because there are very creepy aspects to the novel. But I think they're rather unusual, rather than, and I love a good monster, being chased by a giant monster with lots of tentacles and mouths on the end of the tentacles and eyeballs on the other tentacles and whatever. the scenes here that are very, I would call in the, what we used to call back in the 80s, quiet horror, was there were just some scenes where with the little sister, you know, being studied by these anonymous researchers. And those moments are extremely creepy and terrifying because you do a good job of mining, you know, what they imply, what small things imply. So talk about, you know, using the small details that imply fairly awful things.
Yes, I like that. Yeah, because I do think that this quiet horror is a good way of describing this book. It's definitely not a book that's going to have, like, you know, a bunch of jump scares. That's fine. I love that stuff too, but that doesn't tend to be what I write. It tends to be these more small moments of kind of existential horror of the things that are so scary to have to deal with. And yeah, so, like, you know, the little sister is being poked and prodded at one point, you know, at several points throughout. And, you know, they're trying to analyze, you know, aspects that are either coming out of the neighborhood or people and from the neighborhood. And so that is, like, it's an interesting thing to, like, you know, deal with these small moments that seem very mundane, that seem very banal, but that can pack a lot of, like, uncertainty and that those feelings of fear or dread. I always love, like I always say, existential dread's like my favorite type of horror because it feels like it's what I can relate to the most. Just that, like, daily stuff of, like, oh gosh, life is can be so hard, just like living. And that's what I'm always trying to kind of, like, work into my own writing. Cause I always say, write what scares you. And that's what scares me, is just like those day-to-day interactions with people that can be strange or difficult or just things that can seem so mundane. Mundane that maybe somebody else can get through and they're cool, but it might upset you. And, like, then not only are you upset, but then it's something that other people might not understand. So there's that kind of disconnect. So that's definitely something I was working on integrating into this book.
I love that idea, existential horror. I remember back in college and dinosaurs roamed the earth, and I was reading a Jean-Paul Sartre's novel, Nausea, which was, I still think of, was one of the most terrifying novels I've ever read. And I think that this gets to a lot of that kind of under your skin fear. There are some kind of, like, things in here that I would see as almost like jump scares. I think you have a kind of a, at times this book, it's interesting because you do have many, many moments of the characters' insights, and those are scary. But you also effectively combine them with some kind of visual moments in the neighborhood. And so also, it just struck me that, you know, a major character in this novel is, in fact, the neighborhood. So talk about creating a neighborhood and what has transformed, you know, turned this what normally anonymous unit of the dwellings dumped on a landscape into something that's more, that is a thing in to itself.
Yeah, like, I've always loved settings, like physical places that feel like characters, you know, Haunting of Hill House or Castle Dracula or, you know, the lab in Frankenstein, you know, all these places that have a really specific feel, the moors in Wuthering Heights or Thornfield and Jane Eyre, Manderley and Rebecca. Like, I just love these places that it's like, you know, I love houses with names too. That's like a thing I love from Gothic literature. It's like the best. It's like you're totally admitting that this house is a character because it's even got a name. And so I always love that kind of stuff. And so when I was writing this, I was definitely aware of, like, I want this neighborhood, I want this street to have this feel that, you know it, you have this impression of what kind of person it is almost. And the Talitha definitely attributes behavior to it over time as well. She did even before it was supernatural, but then in particular, once it kind of falls off the map, then she's really, you know, sees it as being very sentient and kind of aware.
You just, I think in your answer there, just created a new genre, the supernatural suburban gothic. And this novel really does actually fit many of the rules of the gothic novel. You have a lone heroine who comes back to a bad place and has to go into the bad place and survive all the horrible things there, most of which she's either responsible or feels responsible for. And that is an interesting kind of divide because, on one hand, we have all many experiences in life. And we might know that in some kind of factual way that we shouldn't feel bad about them. We did what we could at the time, and that was that. But in reality, we just feel terrible. We did something terrible. We judge ourselves to be monsters often enough to maybe make ourselves become monsters.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think many horror fans or people who like the gothic feel that way, that, there's the kind of this monstrous element to who we are as human beings. I very much feel like that. And so I think that that's a very interesting insight. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Were there other gothics? I mean, you mentioned Wuthering Heights, one of my favorite horror novels of all time. That informed you? Were you? I mean, because I can kind of see, the surroundings of Velkwood are not unlike the moors around, Wuthering Heights. And so, talk about, the echoes of the past. When you write, were you thinking about old books or new books or? People are People magazine or Look or Life. Life magazine was my suburban magazine of the 1960s.
I love that. I love that. Yeah, I think it was, I was thinking about the Gothic a lot. I think about the Gothic a lot anyways, even when I'm not writing, because I just love the Gothic so much. So yeah, I mean, I was thinking about the Gothic tradition. I was definitely thinking about Shirley Jackson. I mean, The Haunting of Hill House casts a long shadow over any kind of haunting. I feel like we're all kind of paying homage to her, whether we know it or not. I'm sure there's people out there who haven't read Hill House, but still are probably paying, homage to it, because it's just so much a part of the consciousness at this point. So definitely Shirley Jackson, who's a big favorite of mine. So I was very much thinking of her. And then, like I said, the Brontes are incredible. And just Gothic tradition in general, I think that it's so much fun to kind of take it to settings that maybe it's not normally seen. Though suburban Gothic is a thing. There's definitely, I was just writing an article about this. So that is a thing. Something like David Lynch. I definitely was thinking about David Lynch and like Blue Velvet and Twin Peaks, because there's very much a kind of weird feeling to this neighborhood and to this town. So I was very much kind of thinking about that. There's a diner in the town where she goes a few times, and it's like, it's not nearly as nice as the diner in Twin Peaks. The diner in Twin Peaks is really nice. This one's like a rundown diner, but I definitely was thinking about, like, this is a more rundown version of the diner from Twin Peaks. So things like that, definitely kind of paying, paying homage, paying inspiration to these places and these creators.
There are, I'll read a sentence here. Brett standing on the other side, flashing that sweet smile that could cut you in two. Can I come in? She asks, and my whole life crashes over me in an instant. And that brought to mind this whole idea of, the kind of time dilation one experiences in the other world, where an instant can contain a lifetime. Or, an hour can turn out to be years, which is, or an hour can turn out to be 3 months, as it does in her other world journeys. This is very Rip Van Winkle kind of, idea. And I love the idea of just that, we all, there's this, we think that time moves the same for all of us, but it absolutely does not. We're like all, some of us are riding our bicycles, others are driving fast cars, some people are flying, some of us are walking, some of us are sitting on the couch.
I love that. I love that so much. That's such a great way of describing time. It's so true, because I do feel like, and you could be on a plane one day and on your couch the next, right? Like, I feel like, that can so be how it is. Life can move so fast and then move so slow. And sometimes you want things to move slower and they move too fast. And sometimes you want them to be fast and they move too slow. And I think that that is interesting, how much time is very relative. And that's been something I've always felt. And A book that I don't talk about a lot that's an inspiration on me is Childhood's End, because there's the whole concept in it that when the overlords came, it sent like a shockwave back through time, that like that's why human beings were afraid of things that looked like them, because it affected time, because it was like the end of humanity. I mean, spoiler alert for this book that's like 50 years old. But I always thought that was so interesting about how time might not even be linear. What if it's not, like, we at least think, okay, we move forward through time, but that's something I was thinking of when I was writing this, of like they can go back in time into this neighborhood that's trapped in time, because what if time isn't linear? There's some even scientific theories of that, that maybe there's a non-linear form of time, and that, you know, it's almost like this circle, right? And that really, like, I kind of love it, but it also, I kind of hate it because it freaks me out a little bit. But at the same time, I think it's interesting. And I think, like I said, Childhood's End, I always loved that kind of core concept of it, of like, something could happen in the future that was so extreme that it affects the past. And it's like that like opens up a whole new idea of the way that life works. And so that was definitely, oddly, that's an odd inspiration for this, but that was definitely there in one form or another, and just my way of thinking about time.
That's fascinating. You know, also too, you say at another point, but we couldn't run, not yet. It's such a strange thing to be 17, so close to freedom, yet 1,000 miles away. The future was unfurling before us, but sometimes it didn't feel like our future at all. And I think that, you know, that age is really an interesting age, because that's where time is completely messed up for you. On one hand, you think you're brilliant and you're an adult, you're just gonna conquer everything, bang, bang, bang. And that's not the way it generally works out.
But yeah, and then yet you're so young at the same time, and you don't even realize how young you are until like you're older, and then you're like, oh, I was really young then. Like you said, like I had all these ideas, and I was like, you know, so sure about so many things. And then you get older, and I often said the older I get, just the more questions I have rather than more answers. It feels like, you know, that it goes the opposite way. Like you're young, you think you have all the answers. You get older, you have more questions than you have answers. And yeah, I do think that age in particular is such, like, time is, like how you said, it's just very messed up. It's very messed up at that point, because you've lived enough to have some life experience, but not long enough to have enough to know as much as you think that you do.
In the movie Shaun of the Dead, one of the most effective scenes is the scene where he's on the bus and he's surrounded by all these people. And I was just going, and you realize that, you know, that the difference between all those people on the bus with him and zombies, not so much. And I think that you do this in this book, where there's a, my mother and I didn't speak all the way to school. All the way to school, or when she helped me unpack my luggage in a dorm room I was sharing with a stranger. She didn't have to say anything. Her voice was already on repeat in my head, droning over and over again until the words barely made sense anymore. Her mother is already a ghost to her before she really becomes a ghost. And I think that this is a fascinating idea, you know, that the people around us can be ghosts to us, essentially. You know, they can just haunt us because we don't even, in a sense, there are people around me who haunt me just because, you know, I don't take them seriously, yet they're saying things that are utterly and frighteningly true.
Yeah, I do think that it is interesting how people can be ghosts to us, even if they're still alive, and whether they're in our lives or not, because, you know, Talitha's mom's still in her life at that point. But then obviously, if there's somebody from your past that you don't speak to for whatever reason anymore, they do become a ghost, even if they're still alive somewhere out there. Because in a way, if they're not part of your life, they're already kind of like a ghost. They're already part of your past. So yeah.
And you know, this book has a very kind of a page turning, but also really poignant finish. And I want you to talk about, you know, combining those two, because to a certain extent, you know, that they work against one another usually. But I think you do a good job of making the emotions of your characters the plot, as opposed to necessarily so much their actions in this world and the other world. Talk about, you know, making a writing a novel. This is very different from Reluctant Immortals.
Yes.
And that was something I really enjoyed, because that book was really fun and it was smart and it was, you know, it stayed with me and the scenes and characters stayed with me. But this book is written in a very, very different style. Mm-hmm. How did you, you know, feel about going from one style, kind of a fun romp in a sense, but also with great characters and you know, a great plot, to a book that's, you know, this is all interior, all first person, and she's not a happy or super, you know, she's not the first person who's charging into things with two guns in each hand and you know, a grenade ready to throw.
Yes, yes, it is very different. So like Lucy as our narrator in Reluctant Immortals is much more like, I'm ready. Like she doesn't want to have to fight, but she's much quicker to get into the fight and deal with this than Talitha is. So yeah, you know, I mean, I'm very proud of this book, but Reluctant Immortals was more fun to write. It's a more fun book. You know, it's probably less scary than Velkwood. I think Haunting of Velkwood is much more of like a horror book. Reluctant Immortals is a horror book, but I always said it was almost like a Hammer horror movie, that there's the horror elements, but it was almost like a horror adventure, which is a different type of horror. And so I kind of wrote Reluctant Immortals as being like my Hammer movie, which I just love Hammer films. So it was a lot of fun. Then this one was a lot, you know, darker and a lot more somber. And like you said, there's poignant, it's much more poignant in parts. More people have said that they've cried at the end of reading Velkwood than they did at the end of Reluctant Immortals. I had a couple people say that they kind of teared up at the end of Reluctant Immortals because it's got like a little bit of a poignant ending too. But it is, it's much more of a romp. It's much more of an adventure story. And so this one was a lot darker, a lot more somber. And it took me longer to shake this one. With Reluctant Immortals, it was just like, yay, you know, I finished it. And it's like, hooray. And Velkwood is it's more difficult. It is. I mean, I hope I'm not making it sound too difficult. It's got fun parts too. And there's definitely like you said, the kind of adventure through the other world. There is that element in there. So it's definitely not all somber, but like you said, it is more interior. It is, you know, there's a lot more darker elements to it.
It's David Lynch or David Cronenberg versus Steven Spielberg.
Yes, that's very good. Very
but,
good.
But we might, well, we enjoy them all.
Yes.
So how do you write novels in that? Do you wait till one's entirely done to begin the next, or is one already boiling when one's writing?
Usually I wait. I write them more one at a time. I do a lot of short fiction, and so I tend to write the short fiction while I'm writing novels. And so I, you know, kind of am doing that at the same time, but usually only one novel at a time. Like, you know, this is my fourth novel, I think. So, you know, short stories, I've written well over 100, probably close to 200 published short stories at this point. Definitely, I think 150 or so. But with novels, it's like still, I always still feel like I'm kind of learning what I like best with novels. I'm working on my fifth novel now. You know, it's not done yet. A lot of people, when they have their novel out, they're like, here's my next novel. It's coming out. I'm like, I'm still working on it. I've worked on a lot of short fiction in the meantime and done a lot of short nonfiction. So always writing. But with novels, it's usually one at a time. I don't usually do two at a time. Maybe someday. I don't know. But not yet.
I saw much of this book in my tiny diseased brain as a movie. So I'm wondering, it seems like there's a certain kind of movie that, you know, it's like I say, a little bit of Cronenberg and a little bit of the docu-genre in a sense, because this has, you know, that kind of background, you know, where there are characters, you know, all the researchers and Jack are characters who are interested in documenting the supernatural. And this has a bit of that flavor. Is there any interest in that yet? Or is that something you would like to see?
That'd be great to see. There's been like a little bit here and there, nothing official yet. But yeah, I mean, hopefully that would be great. I feel like most people want to see their stuff made into a movie. So fingers crossed, we'll see.
We'll look forward to your next novel sooner rather than later. And I imagine it will be very different. I've been speaking with Gwendolyn Keist. Her new novel is The Haunting of Velkwood. Thank you for joining me, Gwendolyn.
Thank you so much for having me back.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.